Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. This is the morning of the month that we talk about investing, financial planning. We've been doing that for a long time on a regular basis because we knew people would always have questions. So this is your opportunity to call in and ask very specific questions about your financial situation. You're thinking about making some investment decision and you'd just like to have a little bit of advice. Well, we can help you out. The guest this morning is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance at the College of Business here at U of I and one of our really two core guys that have been doing this program with us for a very long time. So if you have some questions, specific questions, please do take advantage of his expertise, and you can give us a call. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Also, email is possible. You can send in your question that way. Will-talk@illinois.edu. And at any point, we're happy to have your question. Say thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's always good to be with you.
And we have updated the couch potato portfolio for the month. And maybe I should mention here, because we occasionally do get questions about this, and I have one, and I apologize. If the person is listening, I apologize for not having gotten back to them, because it was a question about what specifically are these funds? Where do you find them? And these particular funds, they're all Vanguard funds. And they're pretty much, if you go to the Vanguard website, they're pretty much called essentially what we call them for the couch potato portfolio that people will find at a website. So it shouldn't be hard for people to figure out exactly what fund is it that we're talking about here.
Exactly. The names line up almost perfectly. And the Vanguard website, like many commercial websites, is multi-faceted, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of information. So if during the course of the program we'd like, we could give people a heads up. We could have them bring out paper and pencil. We could have them write down the URL that takes them directly to the single page on the Vanguard website that shows an alphabetical listing of all of their funds and of those funds that are in the couch potato portfolio. We could talk about that if there's caller interest. Sure.
So it should really be easy for people to figure out very specifically what these funds are, what funds we're talking
exactly.
about. Exactly. All right. Well, we do have a caller here, so rather than make them wait, we'll get right to them. And they're in Champaign and on line number two right here. Hello.
Boy, I was surprised. I was thinking it was going to be one right away, huh? This is good.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
You're the winner.
I'm the winner. That's right. These aren't just a couple general questions, and actually one that came up just in terms of TIPS, which was the Treasury, right?
The Treasury Inflation Protected right. Securities, yes.
Okay. You know, if you buy them through like a provider, you're talking just now. Are they actually guaranteed? Not guaranteed, but the principal is that guaranteed? The actual gross amount that you put in.
Something happened
because generally, sometimes the one that I'm in the TIAA and Kraft, it says TIPS, but it's a combination of other ones. It's not all Treasury, right? Government Treasury. Sometimes they throw in some other things in there.
Well, you've made a very great question for number one question of the day. And here's why I say it's great, because you've actually brought up two facets with perhaps not realizing it. The first facet is the investment itself. Let's call that a Treasury Inflation Protected Security, a TIPS. The TIPS are obligations of the federal government. As a security, you can tell yourself that they're as safe as the U.S. government's ability to pay on its debt. Now let's go to the second step. The second step is you've mentioned a fund. One way to buy TIPS is through a mutual fund, whether it's a Vanguard or any other of many different mutual fund companies. And now we're talking about an overlay, so we're looking at an opportunity for a person to put money into a portfolio of securities, a collection. In that structure, in theory, the value, the rate of return, and the security of the principal should be a flow through to what the securities within the portfolio are. So in other words, I should be putting my money into U.S. government guaranteed securities. However, I will tell you that you're moving your money into those securities through a conduit. That conduit is the mutual fund company, and you are buying mutual fund shares, which basically is a pro rata interest in the entire portfolio that the mutual fund company has put together. What they do with those securities outside of what might be a majority of the money invested in TIPS is entirely within their control based on what the prospectus of that fund says they can do. So let's get simple. If you want to buy TIPS, you can buy them directly through the United States Treasury. You can set up a Treasury direct account, and just like buying a U.S. Treasury bill, note, or bond, you can buy TIPS directly through the Treasury.
So in other words, there's no fee either?
That is correct.
Okay, and then a couple quick questions. One is, in terms of the banks, where a bank can go and actually, what they call it, like at the window or somewhere or other, they can get a loan, and that's at what, 1% or less? Is that right?
Are we talking about a bank borrowing from the Federal Reserve System?
Right.
That would be the discount window?
Right, discount window. There we go. Now, and they actually can then turn that around and buy bonds, right? Federal, treasury, right? Notes, and get 3%, right? Is that correct?
Well, a bank can borrow money from the Federal Reserve System, from the Federal Reserve Bank, and it can use that money to invest in anything as a permissible investment for the bank. So I guess I would answer your question with yes.
So now who's paying that interest? And we the people are sort of paying the interest, right? The difference? They can borrow it at close to zero, and they can actually make money on that.
That is a correct statement.
Okay. All right. Finally, I know that you're a trader because I've listened to the program, and that what do you think this, what they call it, high-frequency trading?
Yes.
Do you think, does that have an effect? Or do you, in fact, I think the percentage is increasing. Now it's 2% and something like 75% of the frequency in trading. Does that have an impact? Have you seen an impact in terms of your trading? Or certainly in terms of variability of the market, it certainly should have some impact, correct?
My personal opinion on the whole topic of high-frequency trading is a lot more involved than just, how should we say, the existence of it. But in a regulatory sense, my opinion is not a favorable opinion. I think we have a big problem with this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and it's so long in terms of discussion. I could see that.
We could make a two-hour call-in show on that topic alone.
Right. But I could see where it could cause a lot. It's not sort of like you're investing in a market anymore. All of it is you're looking for the differences and you're trading on these differences.
Well, and in some extent, we're even creating the differences that we're trading on in that abusive setting.
Well, I appreciate your input. These are questions I've had, and I do value this program a great deal. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. So now just out of curiosity, I guess I haven't checked this in a while. What are Treasury bonds and bills paying these days for interest rate?
Funny you should ask, because interest rates are, as usual, or I should say as recent experience would have it, we are not seeing generous rates of return on things like U.S. Treasury securities. I'll give you for some instances. On a six-month Treasury bill, you could expect the generous yield of 14 basis points. That's 14 one-hundredths of 1%. That's six months. Mm-hmm. 12 months, you run up to an outrageous 20 basis points. At 2 years, 37 basis points. You don't cross one full percentage point until you go out as long as 5 years, at which point the current yields I pulled down this morning, 1.13% for a five-year Treasury note.
So they are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So I suppose if you're concerned about security, That might be something you would think about. I would think, though, that if you went to a bank, you got a CD, it's insured, you could surely you could do better than that.
It varies. I would always encourage a person to shop between certificates of deposit and U.S. Treasury bills or notes. The differences are going to be, in many instances, slight.
Really?
This is the environment we live in. It is and has been called a zero interest rate environment. Our Federal Reserve, in its most recent announcement, has said nothing about changing that. A month ago release of the Fed minutes basically forecast that this policy will be in effect through the middle of 2014.
That's what I was thinking that I heard, that they were saying essentially they thought that interest rates would be about zero and not much change for another year and a half, more, a little bit more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's pretty much the line.
All right. We have another caller. This is someone in Urbana. We'll go right there. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Now you cannot buy a U.S. savings bond from a bank anymore. You have to buy them online. And I used to like to give them to children as gifts. But I don't like to put my bank account number online. So I'm just wondering, is there any other way to buy a savings bond?
To the best of my knowledge, no. The U.S. Treasury, the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank is sort of the bookkeeper for Treasury direct accounts, and the Treasury Department of Treasury really has made an extra effort over the past 2 to 3 years that forces everybody to deal directly with the Treasury. And you can kind of understand this from an efficiency point of view, or from a economies of scale point of view. They'd like to have everything be as automated as possible through an electronic database of transactions and activities. So toward that end, if our federal government is extracting some efficiencies out of a process that allows us to lend money to our government, then theoretically we should all benefit from that lower cost in either a higher rate of return or obviously lower cost directly to the government that might mean less taxes paid by everyone in the country. Bottom line is, I mean, logically it makes sense. I understand your lack of comfort. It is, I would say, a secure website. It is dealing with the Fed system itself. If I could give you any comfort at all, the Federal Reserve runs a wire system between all member banks and has for many, many years, and that wire system is extremely secure and safe. They have a lot of history of experience with, treating things of a very confidential nature like bank accounts. They have a very good track record with.
Right, but so do the hackers are pretty good too, you know?
Well, I understand, and I guess we live in a world where there are risks associated with every, benefit we garner with technology.
Yes, right. Okay, I have another question. I annuitized an annuity because I thought I needed the money every month, and I changed my mind, and I didn't want to spend it. It was coming in every month for 15 years. I couldn't change it. So I'm dollar-cost averaging it into several accounts, and it's costing me a fee of $11 a month. Is there any other way I can put that money away? Maybe just to take it and buy CDs, huh?
Who is charging $11 a month fee? Is it the place where you're dollar cost averaging?
Yes, financial advisor, yeah.
Well, then I would recommend shopping for...
It's through the mutual funds. They charge that much. It's going into mutual funds, and they charge that much.
Well, not all funds charge the same amount.
Right.
So
right.
I would shop around and suggest that you look for a more cost-effective way of doing this. Whether it's a Vanguard family of funds, Fidelity, any one of a number of fund companies. I mean,
it's American funds.
The process that you're describing is basically one that's available through many companies. It is a very competitive marketplace, and I could tell you that that's probably something that you could easily find a way out of.
I mean, a lower fees.
Yeah, I mean, put the money into a different mix of funds at a different fund company, and you'd probably find that you wouldn't have to pay any monthly fees.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Right.
You're
welcome. Good. Thank you. Our guest in this hour of focus is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. This is our monthly show on personal finance, money management. So whatever questions you have on financial planning, you can give us a call, discuss the situation with Kevin, and he'll give you his advice. You can take that as being one piece you put in your basket of advice.
I'd like to say that I don't really give advice. I only make observations.
Oh, well, if you're interested in having some of his observations on your financial situation, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. And in fact, here's an email from someone who writes this. I have a friend who is on disability who has a small nest egg from her husband's life insurance, which she needs to invest. I think a retirement fund of some sort makes sense as long as she can get to it if she needs it. What would you recommend? She is about 50 years old.
Good question. First of all, without knowing a lot of the background, I would ask if she is taking advantage of an IRA, whether it's a regular or a Roth IRA. I think those would be some of the things to explore initially. That kind of answers only part of the question, though, because it's really the structure or the type of account as an IRA. Beyond that, as we've talked with our first caller, we'd like to look at, make sure that the investments within that account make sense. So if the money is going into something that is, a guaranteed principal, whether it's a certificate of deposit at a bank or some type of treasury security, The thought process I have always goes more than one direction. The first direction might be the actual structure of an account, but always, if we're talking about investments, we've got to look beyond that and say, what are the securities being invested in? So, difficult question to answer in the surface of an email.
All right. Well, there's a second question here, and I think it's possible that it might be better dealt with by the guests that we have coming in for the second hour, because we have two accountants with us for hour two to take tax questions. It's a tax question, and I'm not
lovely.
Sure how well that you could deal with this. The person writes that she, the friend, the same person we were talking about, has an old issue with the IRS related to her mother's estate. She's very worried they may take her funds before her attorney can get it handled. And do you know if the IRS can take retirement funds?
I would defer that to the guest coming
guys,
in,
yeah,
the next
okay.
guy. I don't want to reveal too much bias I have as it relates to the IRS.
I see. All right. Well, very well. Well, I hope indeed that the person who's listening would be able to hear the second hour today, the 11 o'clock hour today. Celeste Quinn will be hosting that show. She will have here as her guests in the studio John Breen and Marty Verdick. They're both with the local firm of McGladrey and Pullen. So they'll be here to answer tax questions. And I'm hoping that perhaps that listener can write in again. And it's possible that they might need a little bit more detail. So hang on. We'll see if we can get you an answer to your question in the second hour of the show. Let us continue. And we have another caller here. Spring Bay is the caller, and that's line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Thank mm-hmm. you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wonder if the professor would have any observations to make on this. David Stockman, Reagan's budget director, recently had an article in which he was saying he's all in cash. He doesn't trust the stock market. He thinks it's a bad place to be, full of danger and risk. I've also read recently that retail investing the small investor has basically gotten out of the market, that a lot of the action in the market now is, computer trading and high-frequency trading and all of that. And the takeaway on it was that the market is fairly unstable and filled with risk. And so I will get off and listen to whatever observations you care to make on that. Enjoying the program.
All right. Thank you.
That's a great question. To the Stockman writing, I can't directly respond to it. I didn't read it. But I know that it's not an uncommon feeling. It does dovetail quite nicely with the mention of the retail investor basically being out of the market. I think the retail investor being out of the market is probably a place I'd like to begin. To a certain extent, they are out of the market, perhaps as individual investors. There's probably two main reasons for that. First of all, employment is still an issue in this country. We are still not a robust economy. There are still many people that are either unemployed or underemployed very dramatically. And I think with a slow healing process that we've seen to that, it's not unusual to expect that a person's risk tolerance is really pushed into a corner at this point. So taking risk by investing in a stock market is something that a comfort level is not allowing to happen as an individual. But then I'd flip the coin over and look at the other side, and I'd say for those people who are employed, there still are contributions going into retirement plans, whether they're 401k plans at a private sector employer, 403b plans or 529 plans in the public sector. There is still money flowing into investments in bonds, in stocks, and that money is basically payroll deduction money from people who are employed. That money, though, is obviously aggregated through predominantly investment intermediaries, whether they're mutual fund companies, insurance companies, or whatever. So I would like to say that the private individual may not be buying individual funds or bonds, but those private individuals that do have secure enough income are still contributing quite handsomely to things like retirement plans, where those monies are being aggregated. And now you're seeing the quote-unquote professional money managers managing and investing that money for them. So the bottom line is there is a bias in place right now where most of the activity of investing is being done by institutional investors, but the source of that money to a great extent is still individual household savings. So it's a little bit different way of looking at it. When we get outside of the impact to low employment or underemployment circumstances of the economy, I know that a lot of people that are younger and in the workforce have basically cut their teeth seeing what's happened with the Great Recession. And again, we've got a shell shock reaction going on. To a certain extent, we've probably overly sensitized younger people into being very leery of things like the stock market. A good, healthy dose of skepticism is always warranted when we look at things like investment markets that have uncertainty in them. That uncertainty will always be present. But unfortunately, I think we're still dealing with the tail end of a very, very ugly occurrence. And some of the younger people that basically did not have an opportunity to see anything but the ugly side are still scared. They're still cautious to go into an investment process individually. Now to timing. I'm a very poor timer, even though I continue to try. So I guess it's a little bit like saying I'm the guy that continues to beat his forehead against a brick wall and wonder why it's still bleeding. But that said, just some reference points. The Standard & Poor's 500 is roughly 1,402 this morning. The highest it traded at was 1,576. That was an intraday level. The highest close on it was 1,565. Both of those were back in October 2007. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is, even since the lows in March of 2009, the market has done dramatically well in terms of a recovery. When we think of the S&P 500 back in March of 2009, to recover to this 1400 level is very dramatic. The couch potato performance year to date, that's just January 1 through yesterday's closing prices, is up 12.7%. So, there is purchase of assets going on. Those assets are stocks. And I guess it really makes sense to me because of two things. First of all, we know interest rates are just hideously low. And if you wanted to do a little reading, I would encourage you to go back and do a little reading of the Federal Reserve Chairman's remarks made at the Jackson Hole confab last year when Ben Bernanke basically came out and gave his profession, his views, his thoughts on the portfolio balance channel. This is Fed speak. It's all kind of weird stuff. But the bottom line is, I think you'll see that one of the goals of our central bank is to get people to take risk and to buy assets that are things like stocks that have a higher rate of return than safe investments like U.S. Treasury securities or CDs. That's a part of their methodology in getting people back into what they would say is a more normal functioning economy.
We're talking this morning about financial planning, something we do each month on the program. Kevin Wasp is our guest from the Department of Finance at the U of I. We will talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible with support from the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, we'll be set up here to take your tax questions, the deadline for filing only 1 month away. And when it comes time to fill out the returns, you certainly want to meet the deadline. You don't want to pay more than you owe. You want to get it right. We'll see if we can help you with that in the second hour of the show. We'll have two tax experts from the firm of McGladrey & Pullen to take your questions. Marty Verdick and John Breen, Celeste Quinn will be hosting the show. That's hour two today. Monday, another program of a practical nature, something that we do every month on the show. It's our monthly show on home maintenance, and our guest will be Scott Spies. He's a home inspector. So if you have some problem, something needs to be fixed, you're not quite sure how to deal with it, you call in, talk about it with Scott, and he will see if we can help you out. You can go to the website to find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead, and that's will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour of Focus, we're taking questions on money management. We do this every month, always on Friday. Kevin Waspy is the guest. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at the U of I in the College of Business. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a couple other things coming by email. We have somebody here who would like to move their mortgage to paying biweekly rather than monthly. To save interest and the number of payments, and indeed it will do that for you. The question is, will the banks do that? His loan apparently is with one of the local banks. Can you just go into the bank where you have your mortgage and say, can we change the payment setup?
If the mortgage is what you would call a conventional mortgage, the borrower can always pay faster than the monthly payment. So it doesn't require any modification to the contract. Again, this assumes that we're talking about a traditional or conventional mortgage. Mm-hmm. Because with that conventional mortgage, there is no prepayment penalty. There is no prohibition of paying down against the principal anytime or any amount sooner. Bottom line is, they don't even need to talk to the bank if it's a conventional mortgage. All they need to do is either write a check or have them debit an account for a certain amount any day of the week they choose to do it and have it applied against the principal on the balance. That's how it works.
Okay. And I suppose that they could also go to the bank and talk with them about setting it. So they would not have to think about it. The banks may say, yes, we'll debit your account, and rather than doing it once a month, we'll do it twice a month, and we'll just automatically take the money out of there. You sign here, we'll set it up, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Again, very common, and again, the presumption is that it's a conventional or typical mortgage.
Okay.
The bank should be very willing to work with them in that capacity.
All right. Here we have another question from someone who writes in, says that they have asked friends, neighbors, and coworkers, and no one has been able to recommend a financial advisor to them. The person wants to know, how do I find someone trustworthy to help advise and work with me?
That's a great question. As a matter of fact, it goes along with a little talking that was going on before the show began here with one of the people here at the station. You've done what is the first logical answer I would always have, and that is, you know, you talk with friends or family members or so on and so forth. I would guess beyond this point, it becomes a little process of well, you'll need to do a little exploration. You might have to invest a little time and do some interviewing, meet with some people who either hold themselves out to be fee-only planners, or if you start with someone at a local bank who could talk to you about some of the products and services of the bank. I guess the common thread is this. What you want to do is find a person that has your best interest in mind rather than their own. And that's part of the cost of search. So unfortunately, you've not been able to find someone through talking with friends, relatives, whatever. Now you'll have to bear that cost yourself. There's, I guess, no better way to do it, whether we're talking about an attorney, a physician, or a financial advisor.
Now, there is a certification process for financial planners. So one of the things that you might do is look for someone who says that they are a certified financial planner, or ask people if they are certified.
There are credentials in the field, just like there are credentials in most professional fields. Those are certainly good things to use as screening tools. I would tell a person that they are not absolutes, so they may be necessary conditions, but they may not be sufficient conditions. I think most of what this boils down to is literally building trust. This is a relationship, maybe not the same as a courtship between two people trying to decide whether or not they want to live together for the rest of their lives, but in a certain extent, there are parallels. So there is a search cost. Yes, credentials can help you screen. They are not the answer, though. So building trust takes time.
All right. We have another caller here, someone to talk with on the phone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Sir, I'd like you to critique my theory as to why gas prices are going up, and that is that the foreign companies know that our federal government is borrowing 40% of every dollar that they spend, and therefore we do not have any other currency to back up our currency, and they realize that the temptation and probability may be that we will simply print more money because that will be the easiest way out of our massive debt.
I won't critique that necessarily, but maybe I'd even expand on it a little bit. I don't think that this is a phenomenon singularly related to oil prices or gasoline prices. I really don't even think it has anything to do with foreign versus domestic production of goods and services, so on and so forth. I think there is an inflation risk premium in the price of certain commodities. Oil might be one of them. Gasoline, refined products from oil, agricultural products, so on and so forth. And I think, again, that is a premium, a risk premium being put in place, because there is clearly a problem with our current situation. We are on an unsustainable path. We cannot continue to operate as an economy in the way we are operating now. Part of that process is understandable given the Great Recession. Part of what government should have done in the past is act when the private sector was literally in a stupor, when the private sector pulled back away from economic commerce. That's a part of what we would say is a rational reaction by a government. But the question then goes to say, well, how long should they be able to do that? How long can they be able to do that without having repercussions that are unliked, those kinds of things that you mentioned? So, yes, I'm not going to say that you're flawed in your thinking. I'm going to say that maybe your thinking is too narrow. These are going to be potential problems moving forward. We need to have an economy operate in a better, more sustainable fashion.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest for the show this hour, Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. This is our monthly show on money management. And if you have, particularly if you have specific questions about your own financial situation, you're trying to make a decision and you'd like to get some advice, or as Kevin said, if you'd like to have his observations, you can give us a call, 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Anything specific about, you know, where we are right now in this environment, with people being very unsure, people looking for security, but also the things that seem to provide the most security, the return is just pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
How do you just grit your teeth and say, well, okay, if security is that important to you, then that's the trade-off that you have to take?
Well, long before the Great Recession and long before today's conversation, you know that I've liked to use a little phrase: do you want to sleep well or do you want to eat well?
Yeah.
And I think that phrase is ever more appropriate in today's type of environment. Now, the thing to remember is this: the environment changes. Okay, so even though we're in our fourth year, basically, of a zero interest rate environment, would I expect another 4, 8, or 12 of them? And the answer to those are no, ever louder as I go from 4 to 8 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
So do you like what's going on now? I absolutely hate it. As a policy action, I think it's absolutely abysmal. But that's where I write letters to my representatives in Congress and in the Senate. As an action I take as an individual, I'll continue to come back to the basics. When we talk about fixed income savings or investments, I've been an advocate from 40 years ago of a simple strategy of a ladder of maturities. And I think if you're following a ladder of maturities, you're going to have the best result in a given circumstance. You cannot change the circumstance. Your objective is to make the best result in a given circumstance. So things like a simple ladder of maturities, things like asset allocation, things like not stretching for yield, those are basic principles that follow regardless of the circumstances. You don't have to like the current circumstances, but if you can say to yourself you're doing the best with them, then that's the best you can do.
All right. Oh, so we have some other calls here. We have several, and about 10 minutes or so, I think we should manage to get everybody in. We'll do our best, and we'll start with Sycamore up in the northern part of the state. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about stock evaluation. When a private company goes up for sale, that company is evaluated by taking its assets minus its liabilities, and the difference is the true value of the company. That's what it sells for. Well, you do that with some of these, most of the blue chip stocks, and you find that their so-called book value is a very tiny fraction of what they're actually selling for on the open market. So as far as I'm concerned, that's what's keeping this private investor out of the market. I'd like your comment on that, and I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
I agree with a part of your statement, and I'd like to expand on it. When a company goes public, when they first sell stock to the public, the process you mentioned is really not quite as simple as you've described it. What I'd like to introduce you to is a notion of value not based on an accounting measure, but a notion of value based on an economic premise. And here it goes. The numbers on a balance sheet called assets are basically the historical cost of those assets less accumulated depreciation. That's an accounting measure. And to a similar extent, the value on the liability section of a balance sheet are similar. Bottom line is, when I look at an accounting measure called book value, the accounting measure of assets less the accounting measure of liabilities, that book value in many companies is very, very different from what you or I might want to call an economic value. So let's define an economic value. An economic value might be the present value. So now we're going to talk about the time value of money. It might be the present value of all of the future benefits that could accrue to the owner of that company in the future. So now we'll talk about the ability those assets have to produce goods and services at a profit, at which those profits might then be either reinvested within the business to generate more profits or distributed to the holders in the form of dividends. So when I talk about an economic value of a thing like a share of stock, which is nothing more than a pro rata ownership in a firm that's a profitable ongoing enterprise, book value is one of the last things I want to look at. One of the first things I want to look at is the opportunity the firm has to create a rate of return on that invested capital. That then is a more economic measure of value of the firm. Only with some firms, only with a balance sheet, are you able to see things that get beyond basic accountancy rules and accountancy measures. Very, very limited numbers of balance sheets reflect what you or I might call the value of the firm from that perspective. And as a for instance, I would give you a class of stocks that would be things like commercial banks. When I look at the balance sheet of a commercial bank, if the accounting is being applied correctly, the book value should give me some closer measure of economic value of the bank. But for generally companies other than banks, book value is not real helpful.
Okay. Other calls back here locally. Line one is Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I have a question. My daughter recently got a part-time job. She's in high school. And so she has like $1,500 saved. I was thinking, would it be worth it for her financially to get like a Roth IRA or something? Is that something available to high school students? And
yeah.
are there funds that would be low fees so that, because she wouldn't be able to put a ton of money into it. I mean, I just wondering, is there something she could do with that money?
Sure, absolutely. As long as it's earned income, she should have the ability to open up and put a small amount of that money each year into something like a Roth IRA. The greater value in doing that is not really the money aspect of it. You'd mentioned an amount of $1,500. The thing I would say is to establish good habits, good financial habits for life, setting up some type of savings plan, even a simple passbook savings account at a bank as a beginning point is a great thing to do as people begin to create things called earnings. Discipline yourself in saying that a certain percent, maybe 10, 15, 20%, is going to go into that savings account. And if there's an opportunity to do something beyond that, perhaps something like a Roth IRA. Again, you've mentioned low-fee or no-fee type of arrangements. It might be difficult for $100, $200 amounts, but a little bit of legwork, I'm sure you could find even then an opportunity to set up something like a Roth IRA that might give her advantages down the road over and above something like a passbook savings account. But again, the technique that you're describing is a great technique. It's a great technique, in my opinion, for the reason of forming good habits that are good habits for life.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. On to another caller here. This is also Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the show, so I'm not sure of the guests' areas of expertise. I have a question. As someone who is 53 and looking at, right now I'm going back to school to get a certificate in computers so that later when I'm older I'll be able to either work part-time or hopefully full-time at a fairly high income. In terms, and work until I'm 67, but I'm curious about the solvency, your opinion on the solvency of Social Security. My understanding is there's like $3 trillion that the federal government owes Social Security. How long do you think that pool of money might conceivably support people like myself and in my age group in retirement? And that's basically my question.
All right.
Well, depending on whose forecast or study you read, I don't think there's any question of if, it's a question of when. Social Security cannot exist in the present form. Now, that doesn't mean that we're all doomed. Whether we read study that says it's 2035 or the other study that says it's 2037, I don't think we should put that notation on our calendar and expect a big bomb to go off on that date. Bottom line is, like so many things that are of a political nature, the issue with changes in the actual benefits and the rate of tax that supports those benefits and the demographics of our population have a collision in our future. We cannot continue to do Social Security the way we do it now and expect it to last. It won't work. So the bottom line is this. I would say rather than putting a date on your calendar and saying that's when the bomb goes off, or I'm not going to do anything to get involved with that because it's going to blow up, the process is one of saying how do you get the best decision-making opportunities today with a situation of unknowns. And the unknowns are hopefully the tough questions are dealt with, the tough decisions are made, and that's more of a political process. So I would encourage you more to expend your energies not on the financial aspect of Social Security, but on the political aspect of Social Security. Read more about it. Become more of an advocate to your elected representatives and suggest some changes that need to be made.
We have about a minute and a half. I have two emails. I don't think we can do both. Let me try to do at least one. Someone writes in that they have an old retirement plan from another university, a 401k, a 401a with Fidelity in mutual funds. There's less than $20,000 there, and the person is thinking, well, should I just leave the money there, or should I pull it out and pay whatever penalties might apply?
Does it say if they're currently employed?
No.
Okay. If they're currently employed, that money should be eligible for a rollover contribution into the current employer's plan. Okay. That's one option. Another option is that money, if it's pre-tax money, if it's qualified money, as we like to call it, should be eligible for rolling into an IRA. So whether it's rolled into an IRA that you know, invests in super secure things like certificates of deposit at a bank, or an IRA that has a selection of mutual funds available through a fund company or whatever, that gets to the investment decision part of the process. But unless the person wants the money as disposable income now, there's really no need for them to break the money out of that plan, pay the tax on it, and then do things.
Okay. Well, here's one more. This may be a little too complicated to do in the time we have, but here we go. A person writes that she and her husband have a small family business. They also have a personal debt estimated between $40,000 and $50,000 that they are steadily paying off. They'd like to continue paying off the debt, but they'd also like to invest in their business. A $40,000 investment in the business, they estimate, would yield about $25,000 in profit every year. So the question is, what do you think? Is it better to pay off the debt first or invest the cash in the business?
The income forecast has risk associated with it. The debt does not. So if the calculation for risk is, how should we say, incorporated in the decision, if they feel that they can literally produce those profits annually and for a sustained period of time, then that would be apparently the better investment.
All right. Very good. Well, I hope that that helps for everybody. Also, of course, like to remind you that if you're thinking about your tax situation, we got a show for you, hour number two, an opportunity to call and ask questions about federal and state taxes for 2011. Celeste Quinn will be here for the next part of the show. Her guests will be John Breen and Marty Verdick from McGladrey and Poland. So definitely do tune in and call in if you have questions. Also, our thanks to our guest this hour, Kevin Waspe. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. We do these shows on personal finance once a month. It's always on Friday. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. It's always fun.